when I'm feeling blue.
Today on Off Mic, a special holiday Christmas performance by the What the Hay Players.
He doesn't mind the snow, and he doesn't.
Sit back and enjoy.
But all December you will hear him at your window pane, singing again and again and again and again.
Hello and Merry Christmas. I'm Harry Bartell. We bring you this very special Christmas Day performance of Sherlock Holmes. Before we get to our story, let me introduce you to our very own Betty Snow. Betty, take it away.
God rest ye merry gentlemen, let nothing you dismay. Remember Christ our Savior was born on Christmas Day to save us all from Satan's power when we were gone astray. Oh, tidings of comfort and joy, comfort and joy. Oh, tidings of comfort and joy.
How delightful. Thank you, Betty, for that great performance. Now, Petrie Wine brings you Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce in the new adventures of Sherlock Holmes. Once more, we're about to visit Dr. Watson, a friend and chronicler of Sherlock Holmes and his amazing adventures. We find him sitting in his well-worn armchair, an eager look on his face and a humorous twinkle in his eye.
Good evening, Mr. Bartell. Tonight I have my narrative all picked out. Have you ever noticed that red-headed people seem to lead interesting and eventful lives? Look at Queen Elizabeth.
Yes, and I heard Cleopatra was a bricktop, and she certainly had a few dull moments.
No, sure she didn't. Well, tonight I decided to tell you the story of the Red-Headed League.
The Red-Headed League? What a curious title.
No more curious than the situation it gave rise to in Sherlock Holmes' life. And as soon as your word with our listeners is out, I'll begin.
Well, I had an adventure tonight, and I wish you could have shared it with me. I had a steak about, an inch and a half thick, tender and juicy, and with it, I had a glass of Petrie California Burgundy. The name Petrie is the proudest name in the history of American wines. And now, Dr. Watson, how about the Red-Headed League?
Well, the adventure began one day in the year 1890, I believe it was. It was just after my marriage, and I hadn't seen much of Sherlock Holmes lately. Anyway, I burst in upon my old friend to find him deep in conversation with a stout gentleman with the fiercest red hair it has ever been my privilege to observe. I was about to withdraw when Holmes pulled me abruptly into the room and closed the door behind me.
Ah, Watson, you could not have come at a better time.
I am so glad to hear it, Holmes.
Come in, come in.
I was afraid that you were engaged, you know.
So I am, my dear fellow, very much so. Here is a gentleman I should like you to meet. Mr. Wilson, this is Dr. Watson, my partner and helper in my most successful cases. And I have no doubt that he will be of the utmost use to me in yours also. Watson, this is Mr. Jabez Wilson.
How do you do, Mr. Wilson?
I'm so glad to meet you, Dr. Watson. I hope you will be of some assistance to me.
I always do my best to help my friend Sherlock Holmes on his cases.
Try the settee, Watson. I feel sure that since in the past you have shown such extraordinary interest in everything outside the conventions and humdrum routine of everyday life, you will particularly enjoy the details of this case.
Holmes, you know your cases have been of the greatest interest to me. But what is this particular case about?
Mr. Wilson has been good enough to call upon me this morning and to begin a narrative which promises to be one of the most singular which I have listened to for some time. Perhaps, Mr. Wilson, you would be kind enough to start your tale again, not only because my friend Dr. Watson has not heard the beginning, but because I wish to be sure of every detail of fact, the case being, to the best of my belief, unique.
I shall be happy to do so, Mr. Holmes.
Can you find the advertisement that appeared in the newspaper?
Yes, I have it now. Here it is. This is what began it all, Dr. Watson. Here, just read it for yourself.
Now, let me see. Here?
Yes, that's it.
To the Red-Headed League. On account of the bequest of the late Ezekiel Hopkins of Lebanon, Pennsylvania, USA, there is now another vacancy open which entitles a member of the league to a salary of £4 a week for purely nominal services. All red-headed men who are sound in body and mind and above the age of 21 are eligible. Apply in person on Monday at 11 o'clock to Duncan Ross at the offices of the League, 7 Pope's Court, Fleet Street.
Curious, is it not?
Well, what does it mean?
That is what we must find out. But before I ask Mr. Wilson to relate any more, I ask you, Watson, to note the paper and the date.
It is the Morning Chronicle of April 27th, 1890, just 2 months ago.
Very good. Now, Mr. Wilson?
It is just I have been telling Mr. Sherlock Holmes. I have a small pawn broker's business at Corbett Square of late years. It has not done more than give me a bare living.
You work it alone?
No, I have an assistant. Though, to tell you the truth, he should not be able to employ him if he did not agree to work for such low pay.
What is his name?
His name is Vincent Spaulding. I should not wish a smarter assistant. He could earn better money elsewhere, but if he's satisfied, I'm not the one to put ideas in his head.
You are indeed fortunate. In this age, I don't know that your assistant is not as remarkable as your advertisement.
He has his faults, too. Never was there such a fellow for photography. That is his main fault, but on the whole, he's a good worker.
He is still with you, I presume, sir?
Yes, he is. We've lived very quietly, the two of us, for I'm widowed, with no family, and we keep a roof over our heads and pay our debts, if we do nothing more. The first thing that interrupted our dull and quiet lives was his advertisement. As a matter of fact, it was my assistant, Vincent Spaulding himself, who called it to my attention.
How was that?
He came into the office just this day, 8 weeks ago, with his very paper in his hand, and he said,
Mr. Wilson, I wish that I were a red-headed man.
Why should you wish that?
Why, here's another vacancy in the red-headed league. It's worth quite a little fortune to any man who qualifies, and I understand they can never find enough men with hair of just the right shade. Why, if my hair would only change to the same color that your hair is, I could step into a nice fortune.
I've never heard of it. What is it?
I wonder that you don't know of it, for you're eligible yourself for one of these vacancies. What, with your flaming red hair?
What are the vacancies worth?
Merely a couple of £100 a year, but the work is slight, and it wouldn't interfere with other occupations.
Tell me about it. A couple of hundred a year would certainly come in handy.
As far as I can make out, the league was founded by an American millionaire who was very peculiar in his ways. He himself had red hair and wanted to make life easier for those who were like him. From all that I hear, it is splendid pay and very little to do.
There would be millions of red-haired men that would apply.
Not so many as you might think. You see, it is confined to grown men from London. And as for color, why, the man's hair must be bright, blazing, and fiery red like yours.
Bright, blazing, fiery red like yours. Yes, Mr. Holmes and Dr. Watson, those were the very words he used. You can readily see for yourselves that my hair is of a full, rich color, so I decided upon Spaulding's urging that I would have to have a try at it.
What happened after that, Mr. Wilson?
Well, sir, I went to the specified address at the appointed time, accompanied by my assistant, Spaulding. Let me say that I never hoped to see a sight such as that again. Every man who had a shade of red in his hair, I didn't think there were so many in the whole country as were brought together by that advertisement. Every shade of color, they were straw, lemon, orange, brick, eider setter, liver, clay. But as Spaulding pointed out, none was as bright as my own. Well, sir, we pushed and pulled and jammed our way forward and finally found ourselves next in line at the office door.
Your experience has been a most entertaining one, Wilson.
Indeed, yes. Pray, continue with your story.
The office itself was a small one, nothing peculiar about it. Behind the desk sat a man whose hair was redder than mine. As we entered the office, he shut the door and said,
Your name, sir?
This is Mr. Jabez Wilson, and he is willing to fill a vacancy in the league.
He is admirably suited for it. He has every requirement. I cannot recall when I had ever seen a redhead so fine. May I take hold of your hair, sir?
Certainly, if you like.
No, it stays fast. It's yours, all right. I'm sorry to have had taken this precaution, but we have twice been deceived by wigs, and once by dye. We should not like a recurrence of such deceit.
Oh, no, sir. My hair is my own.
Indeed, it is, sir.
Well, then, Mr. Wilson, my name is Duncan Ross, and I myself am one of the pensioners of the fund left by a noble benefactor. I am pleased to tell you that the position is yours. When shall you be able to enter upon your new duties?
It is a little awkward, for I have a business of mine already.
Never mind that, Mr. Wilson. I shall look after that for you.
When would the hours be, Mr. Ross?
From the hours 10 till 2.
A pawnbroker's business, for that is my trade. It's done mostly at night, so I suppose I can trust my shop to my assistant here. Yes. Yes. Spalding, you're a good man. Yes. 10 to 2 would suit me very well. And the pay?
£4 a week.
And the work?
The work is to copy out of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Don't ask me why. Those are the terms of the will. You must provide your own pens, paper, and ink. But we provide the table and chair. Also, you forfeit the position if you once leave the building during the hours of 10 till 2. Will you be ready tomorrow?
Certainly.
Then goodbye, Mr. Jabez Wilson, and let me congratulate you once more on the important position which you have been fortunate enough to obtain. And welcome to the Redheaded League.
With those words, gentlemen, he bowed me and my assistant out of the room. I was, at the same time, both pleased and puzzled.
Pleased and puzzled? How so?
Well, you see, Dr. Watson, I was pleased with my new source of income, but puzzled over why anyone should want me to copy out the encyclopedia. In fact, the nightfall I had almost convinced myself that it was still a great hoax.
And did it prove to be a great hoax?
On the contrary, the next day when I reported to work, there was an encyclopedia laid open upon the table. The page at letter A. Mr. Duncan Ross was there and he stared me off, then left. At 2 o'clock, he returned, complimenting me upon the amount that I had written, bade me good day, and locked the door of his office after me.
How long did this procedure continue?
This went on day after day, Mr. Holmes, and on Saturday, Mr. Ross came in and threw down 4 gold sovereigns. For my week's work. It was the same the next week and the same the week after. Every morning I was there at 10 and every afternoon I left at 2. 8 weeks passed by like this, and I had written about abbots and archery and architecture and armor and Attica. And I hoped that with diligence I might get on to the bees before very long. It had cost me something for paper, but it was worth it. Then suddenly,
yes,
the whole business came to an end.
To an end?
Yes, sir. This morning, I went to my work as usual at 10 o'clock, but the door was shut and locked with a little square of cardboard hammered onto the middle of the panel with a tack. Here it is. You can read it for yourself.
How curious.
What does it say, Holmes?
The Red-Headed League is dissolved, June 22nd, 1890.
I cannot see that there is anything very funny. If you can do nothing other than laugh at me, I can go elsewhere.
Oh, no. I shouldn't miss this case for the world, but you must admit that it has a slightly comical side to it. Pray, what steps did you take when you found this card on the door?
I was staggered, sir. I did not know what to do. Then I called at the landlord's and asked if he could tell me what had become of the Red-Headed League. He looked at me astonished and said,
"Red-Headed League, you say? I've never heard of such a party."
Well then, can you tell me what happened to Mr. Duncan Ross?
What happened to him?
Duncan Ross.
Ross? I know of no one of that name.
Well, then what happened to the gentleman who rented number 4?
Oh, you mean the red-headed man. His name was William Morris. He was a solicitor and was using my room as a temporary convenience until his new premises were ready. Well, he moved out yesterday.
Where could I find him, sir?
He's at his new offices. Let me see. He did tell me the address. What was it now? Oh, yes. 17 King Edward Street, near St. Paul's.
17 King Edward Street. I'll just have to make a note of that, Mr. Wilson. It may help us.
Well, I already checked, but there was no one there either by the name of William Morris or Duncan Ross. He was a manufacturer of artificial kneecaps. Well, at that, I knew not what to do, so I decided to take the advice of my assistant, Spaulding, who said simply to wait. But I became impatient, sir, and hearing that Sherlock Holmes was very clever at such things, I decided to come here for aid.
And you did so wisely, Mr. Wilson. From what you have said, I think it is possible that a far more serious issue may be at stake than might at first appear.
The issue is quite serious enough as it is. I have lost 4 pounds a week.
Dr. Watson and I will do our best to help you, Mr. Wilson, but first a few questions. The assistant of yours, who first called your attention to the advertisement, how long had he been with you?
He's been with me about a month at that time. He answered an advertisement I placed in the paper.
Was he the only applicant?
No, I had dozens.
Why did you pick him?
Because he was intelligent and handy and would come at half wages, in fact.
What is he like, this Vincent Spaulding?
Let me think. Small, stout built, very quick in his ways, no hair on his face. Well, he's not short of 30. He has a white splash of acid upon his forehead.
Acid, you say? Yes, I thought as much. Have you ever observed that his ears are pierced for earrings?
Yes, sir. He told me that a gypsy had done it for him when he was a lad.
He is still with you.
Oh, yes, sir. I've only just left him. But there, at the clock strikes 7. Must be on my way. Will there be anything else you wish to ask me, gentlemen?
Not for my part, Wilson.
Yes, I have one more question. All the mornings that you were out, did your assistant attend to your business in your absence?
Yes, sir, and he's honest and careful enough. Nothing to complain of, sir. There's never very much to do of a morning.
I believe you have given us all the information we need, Mr. Wilson. I shall be happy to give you an opinion on the subject in the course of a day or two. Today is Saturday, and I hope that by Monday we may come to a conclusion. Good day, Mr. Wilson.
Good day, gentlemen. Dr. Watson, Mr. Holmes.
Watson, what do you make of it all?
I make nothing of it. It is a most mysterious business.
As a rule, the more bizarre a thing is, the less mysterious it proves to be. But we must be prompt over this matter.
What are you going to do, then?
Can your patients spare you for a few hours?
My practice leaves me plenty of free time. But what are we to be about, Holmes?
We are going to the pawnbroker shop of Mr. Jabez Wilson.
Whatever for?
Why, to investigate, my dear Watson, to investigate. There, Watson, see the 3 gilt balls? This is the place.
Yes, Wilson's name is painted over the door. But now that you are here, what are you going to do?
First, an experiment.
Pounding your stick on the pavement?
And now to knock on the door, and I hope that this Spaulding fellow answers.
Won't you step in, gentlemen?
Thank you, but I only wish to ask you how one would go from here to the Strand.
Oh, third right, fourth left, sir.
Smart fellow, that. He is, in my judgment, the fourth smartest man in London, and for daring, I'm not sure that he has not a claim to be third. I've known something of him before.
Evidently, Mr. Wilson's assistant counts for a good deal in this mystery of the Red-Headed League. I am sure that you inquired your way merely that you might see him.
Not him. The knees of his trousers.
And what did you see?
What I expected to see.
Why did you beat the pavement before knocking on the door?
My dear doctor, this is a time for observation, not for talk. We are spies in an enemy's country. We know something of this city square. Let us now explore the parts which lie behind it. Let me see. I should just like to remember the exact order of the houses here. It is a hobby of mine to have an exact knowledge of London. There is the tobacconist's, the little newspaper shop, the Coburg branch of the City and Suburban Bank, the restaurant, and the carriage builders. That carries us right onto the other block, on which stands the pawnbroker's establishment of our friend, Mr. Jabez Wilson. And now, Doctor, your part of the work is finished, for the time at least. This business of Wilson's is serious. A considerable crime is in contemplation. I have every reason to believe that we shall be in time to stop it, but today being Saturday rather complicates matters. I shall want your help tonight, Watson. Will you come to Baker Street at 10? And I say, Doctor, there may be some little danger, so kindly put your army revolver in your pocket. Goodbye for now then, Watson. I'm so glad that you were prompt, Watson.
I could not be anything else. I was so intrigued.
I think that your curiosity will soon be satisfied.
Will you not tell me, Holmes, where we are going or whom we seek?
I shall gladly do both. We are now going to the Coburg branch of the City and Suburban Bank. The man we seek is none other than John Clay.
John Clay? You mean the thief and forger who's escaped the police so many times?
The same, and you may add murderer to your list. His brain is as cunning as his fingers, and though we meet signs of him at every turn, we have never known where to meet the man.
Why, all of London has been on his trail for years.
I hope that I may have the pleasure of introducing you to him tonight. Here, Watson, through here, right ho.
Is this the cellar of the bank, then?
It is. We must act quickly, for time is of the essence. I perceive that the ceiling is thick enough. We are not vulnerable from above.
Nor from below. The floor seems... Why, dear me, a hollow sound.
I must really ask you to be a little more quiet, Watson. Sit on one of those boxes while I shade the light.
What is in these great packing cases, Holmes?
The 30,000 napoleons of French gold from the Bank of France.
What?
It has become known that this gold was being stored, completely packed, in the cellar where we now find ourselves. The directors of the bank began to have misgivings about leaving so large a quantity of gold about, and now it appears that the fears were well justified. The bank is to be robbed tonight, if I am not mistaken.
Indeed. And only the two of us to stop the thieves?
I have requested an inspector and two officers to be at the one possible retreat, the front door.
How, then, will the thieves enter?
Through a hole in the floor.
What?
Look, you, huddle in the shadows. One of the stones is moving. They are coming. Shh!
It's all clear, Archie. Have you the chisels and the bags?
I have you, Clay. Come here. Watson! Watson!
Jump, Archie, jump! We'll swing!
It's no use, John Clay. You have no chance at all.
The devil, you say?
Did not reckon with Sherlock Holmes. There! Ah! It is no use.
So I see. I fancy my friend has escaped, though. I struggle with you, gave him that chance. You are not totally successful.
The door was guarded. There are three men waiting for him.
Oh, indeed. You seem to have figured this out completely. I must compliment you.
And I you. Your red-headed idea was very clever.
Ah, Clay, you'll be seeing your friend soon. In court, you scoundrel!
I beg your pardon. You may not be aware that John Clay has royal blood in his veins. Have the goodness when you address me to always say sir and please.
As you wish, John Clay. Well, would you please, sir, march upstairs, sir, where we could please get a cab, sir, to carry your highness to the police station, sir. You see, Watson, it was perfectly obvious from the first that the only possible object of this rather fantastic business of the advertisement of the League must be to get our not-too-bright friend Jabez Wilson out of the way for a number of hours every day. It was a curious way of managing it, but doubtless there is not a better. The plot was suggested, I am sure, by Wilson's own hair. The £4 a week was a lure, and who could not afford £4 who was gambling on 30,000? They put in the advertisement. One accomplice posed as Duncan Ross. The other made sure Wilson would apply. From the time I heard that the assistant had come for half wages, I knew he had some strange motive for securing the station.
How could you guess what the motive was?
A man's business is very small. It must be then that the house itself was of value. When I thought of the assistant's fondness for photography and his vanishing constantly into the cellar, I'd realized at once that that was it.
Yes, I remember now. Wilson mentioned that.
The description of the assistant convinced me that this was the notorious Clay himself. But what could he be doing in the cellar of a pawnbroker? I asked myself. Why, digging a tunnel, of course. That was the only thing that would require his constant, steady attention for hours each day over a period of months. Then I wondered, what building could he be tunneling into? Our visit to the actual scene itself showed me that. Remember, I observed that the bank was right around the corner from Wilson's.
Now that you mention it, I do indeed.
I surprised you, I recall, by tapping my stick on the pavement. That was to determine whether the cellar extended to the front of the buildings. Then I paid a call on John Clay himself, at that time known to us as Spaulding, the assistant.
Yes, you said you wanted to observe the knees of his trousers. What did you see?
You yourself must have noticed how worn, wrinkled, and stained they were, which was a natural consequence of his burrowing. All my conclusions assembled, I called Scotland Yard and the bank, and secured permission and a key for our admittance.
How could you tell that they would make their attempt tonight?
When they closed their League offices, that was a sign that they no longer cared about Mr. Jabez Wilson's presence. In other words, they had completed their tunnel, but it was essential that they should use it soon, as it might be discovered. Saturday would suit them best, as it would give them 2 days for their escape. For all these reasons, I expected them to come tonight.
Ah, you reasoned it out beautifully. It is so long a chain, and yet every link rings true. It was indeed remarkable, Sherlock Holmes, remarkable.
On the contrary, it was elementary, my dear Watson, elementary.
A fascinating story, Dr. Watson. What a thrilling time you had in the days you were living with Sherlock Holmes.
Well, I can't say I was ever bored.
I should think not. Now, Dr. Watson, what about your next tale?
Well, let me think. Well, Mr. Bartell, I think I'll tell you the story about a clerk who came to Holmes with suspicions regarding a rather odd company that had offered him a very well-paid job. I call it the stockbroker's clerk.
Dr. Watson, that sounds intriguing. We'll get to that story in just a moment. We take this time to remind you of Petri California Wines, delicious and smooth, the perfect wine on this Christmas day. Before our next story, right now we go back to our own Betty Snow for another special performance. Betty, take it away.
Oh, come all ye faithful, joyful and triumphant. Oh, come ye to Bethlehem. Come and behold him, born the King of angels. Oh, come, let us adore him. Oh, come, let us adore him. Oh, come, let us adore him, Christ the Lord.
How delightful. Thank you, Betty, for that great performance. Now, Petrie Wine presents Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce in the new adventures of Sherlock Holmes. The Petrie family, the family that took time to bring you good wine, invites you to listen to Dr. Watson tell us another exciting adventure he shared with his old friend, that master detective, Sherlock Holmes. And now let's visit our old friend and host, Dr. Watson.
Ah, good evening, Mr. Bartell.
Oh, good evening, Doctor.
Come over here and sit by the fire. Sit yourself down. I was just about to get my pipe going.
Well, thank you.
I'm having a cup of tea. Care to join me?
That would be lovely, thanks.
It will keep you from falling asleep from our story tonight.
Oh no, there's no chance of that, Doctor. So are you ready for your new Sherlock Holmes adventure?
Why, yes, I am.
Now, earlier, you told us it would be about a clerk who came to Holmes with suspicions concerning a company that just offered him a very well-paid job.
The most bizarre case I ever encountered. It was the year 1890, after my marriage to my wife, Mary. Most men, when they get married, retire from the world for a little while and allow their lives to become circumscribed by the four walls of their homes. But most men do not have an intimate acquaintance with the master detective, Sherlock Holmes. Therefore, I cannot admit to much surprise when, 3 weeks after my wedding, the bell of my townhouse door was rung, and I opened it to find my good friend, Sherlock Holmes.
My dear Watson, I am truly delighted to see you.
Sherlock Holmes, you old dog. Come in, come in.
I trust that Mrs. Watson has entirely recovered from all the little excitements connected with our adventure of the Sign of Four.
Thank you. We are both well.
And I hope that the cares of your medical practice, coupled with the joys of marriage, have not served to dampen the interest which you used to take in our little deductive problems.
On the contrary, it was only last night that I was discussing them with Mrs. Watson. That sad business of Pondicherry Lodge, for instance. And the curious mystery of the barrel coronet. I wouldn't mind seeing another case like that one.
Then you don't consider your collection closed?
Not at all. I should wish nothing better than to have some more such experiences.
Today, for example, even though you have not been well lately.
How did you ever know that, Holmes?
You know my methods, my dear Watson. I deduced it.
But from what?
From your slippers.
How on earth?
Your slippers are new. You could have not had them for more than a few weeks. Bought them from your wedding trip, I'd say, and the soles of them are slightly scorched. For a moment, I thought that they might have been wet and then burned in the drying. But near the instep, there's a small disc of paper with the shopman's marks on it. The damp would have, of course, removed this. You had, then, been sitting with your feet outstretched to the fire, which a man would hardly do in the middle of June if he were in full health.
You never cease to amaze me, Holmes. It's incredible.
On the contrary, my dear Watson, it's elementary. I am afraid that I'd rather give myself away when I explain. Results without reasons are so much more impressive. But come, let us get to the business at hand. I have a case in Birmingham today. Will you come?
Certainly. What is the case?
My client will tell it to you on the train on our way down. Can you come at once?
In an instant. Let me just get my coat on and have a word with my wife.
Very good. I shall meet you outside your door. I have some instructions for the cab driver, and I wish to take advantage of a few extra minutes in the sun.
After telling my bride about the errand I was about to undertake, I donned my greatcoat and went out the door to find Holmes standing on my step, breathing in the fresh June air.
Ah, here you are, Watson. I have been looking around. I see your neighbour is a doctor, too.
Yes, he bought an old practice, just as I did. As a matter of fact, both our practices are of the same age. They have been here ever since the houses were built.
Ah, then you got hold of the better of the two.
I think I did. But how did you know?
By the steps, my dear Watson. Yours are worn 3 inches deeper than his. But we chat too long. My client is in the cab waiting for us. Come along and I'll introduce you.
With pleasure, Holmes.
Dr. Watson, I would like to present to you a most interesting young man, Mr. Hall Pycroft.
The man whom I found myself facing was a well-built, fresh-complexioned young fellow with a frank, honest face. He wore a neat suit of sober black, which made him look like what he was, a smart young city man, probably employed somewhere as a junior clerk. It was not until we were all in a first-class railway carriage and well started upon our journey to Birmingham, however, that I was able to learn what trouble had driven him to Sherlock Holmes.
We have a clear run here of 70 minutes. I want you, Mr. Pycroft, to tell Dr. Watson your very interesting experience exactly as you told it to me.
With pleasure, Mr. Holmes.
It is a case, Watson, which may prove to have something in it. There are certainly some very unusual features. I shall be glad of the chance to hear the story again so that I may review some of the particulars for myself.
Well, then, I used to be a clerk in a stockbroking firm. I'd been with them 5 years and I was doing very well when the firm was forced to close. They gave me very good recommendations, but that didn't help the fact that I was out of work. So I began to look around. At last, I saw a vacancy advertised at Mawson and William.
The firm on Lombard Street. That's the richest in London.
So it is. And I knew there would be many applicants for the post. But even though I had little chance of getting it, I sent in my letter of application. And believe it or not, back came a letter that's saying that if I would appear the next Monday, I might take over my new duties at once. The pay was better than I had been earning, and the duties were the same. You couldn't have found a happier man in all of London than I was when I got that position.
I can well believe it.
But now, I come to the strange part of the business. I was living in a small boarding house in an in-and-out-of-the-way corner of London. It was all more economical, you know. My funds were somewhat depleted by my long siege of unemployment. I was sitting over my poor supper, thinking about my luck, when the hall porter brought in a card.
Mr. Pycroft, there's a gentleman below stairs to see, sir. Send up this card.
A gentleman? To see me? But nobody knows I live here. Let me see the card. Arthur Pinner, financial agent. I don't know him, but still, why not? Show him up.
Very good, sir.
I wonder, how on earth this fellow knows me? What does he want of me? How did he find me?
Mr. Arthur Pinner, sir.
Mr. Hall Pycroft, I believe.
Yes, sir. Please come in.
You were lately engaged at Coxon and Woodhouse's and are now to be on the staff at Mawson's.
Quite so. You seem to know a great deal about me, sir.
Well, the fact is, I have heard some really extraordinary stories about your financial ability. You remember Parker, who used to be a manager at Coxon's? He can never praise you enough. Among your strong points, I believe, is a good memory, is it not?
It's pretty fair, I must admit.
You don't mind if I test you on that point, do you? I'm sure you read the stock quotations each day. What is the price of Ashires?
106 1/4 to 105 7/8.
And New Zealand Consolidated?
104.
British Broken Hills?
7 to 7/6.
Wonderful. This quite fits in with all I've heard. My boy, you are much too good to be a clerk at Mawson's.
I'm very glad to have a position at Mawson's.
Oh, pooh, man, you should be doing far better. Now I'll tell you how it is with me. What I have to offer is little enough for a man of your ability, but compared to Mawson's offer, it's a fortune. When do you start at Mawson's?
On Monday.
I'll wager you'll never go there at all. By Monday, you will be the business manager of the Franco Midland Hardware Company, Limited, with 134 branches all over France, not counting the one in Brussels and the one in San Remo.
But I've never heard of it.
I dare say you haven't. It's been kept very quiet because we don't want the word to get around until we have already started our operations in England. The competition, you know. Now, my brother, Harry Pinner, is managing director. He has asked me to find a good man to be our business manager. I've heard a good deal about you and have decided that you're the man for me. Although, we're prepared to offer you only £500 a year to start.
£500? But that's four times what Mawson's giving me.
You're worth more, my boy. What do you say to my offer?
It's quite handsome indeed, Mr. Pinner. But I must be frank. Mawson may not pay so handsomely, but it is a safe, secure company. I know so little about yours.
Smart, smart. You are the very man for us. You are not to be talked over. I like that. Now, to answer your question, here's £100 for you, as an advance against your salary. That's security, isn't it?
You have just hired yourself a business manager, Mr. Pinner. When shall I take over my duties?
Be in Birmingham tomorrow at 1:00. I have a note in my pocket which will take to my brother, Harry Pinner. You will find him at this address, where the temporary offices of the company are located. He will explain your duties.
Really, sir, I hardly know how to express my gratitude.
Not at all, my boy, but there are one or two small things, mere formalities, which must be arranged. You have a bit of paper beside you there. Kindly write upon it, "I am perfectly willing to act as business manager of the Franco Midland Hardware Company Limited at a minimum salary of £500.
Minimum salary, £500. There you are.
And one last thing. What do you intend to do about Mawson's?
I declare I'd forgotten about them. I'll write and resign.
Precisely what I don't want you to do. I had a row with Mawson's manager over you. I told him I was interested in you, and he was quite offensive. Said that he had hired you first, and you have no right to consider any other offer, no matter how much to your advantage. As a matter of fact, do you know what he said about you? We picked Pycroft out of the gutter, and he's too grateful to us not to come work here, no matter what you pay.
The impudence!
Those were his very words. Don't you think it would serve him right to give him no notice at all?
Imagine his talking about me like that, when I've never set eyes upon him in my life. I shall certainly not write, if you rather I didn't.
Good. That's a promise. Well, Mr. Pycroft, I'm delighted with our business transaction. We have a good man in you. Now, don't forget to be in Birmingham tomorrow at 1:00 sharp, and present this letter to my brother. He'll be expecting you. I must be off now, but we shall meet again.
Thank you, Mr. Pinner. I'm eternally grateful you can be here.
Never you mind. I'm the one who is grateful. Goodbye for now, and good luck. May you have all the fortune that you deserve.
And was that the entire interview before you took your new position?
That is just about all that had passed between us, as near as I can remember. You can imagine, Dr. Watson, how pleased I was at such an extraordinary bit of luck. I sat up half the night thinking about it, and the next day I was off to Birmingham. After settling in a hotel, I made my way straight to the address that had been given to me.
And what sort of offices did you find?
That was the first thing that startled me. When I got to the building, I looked for the company name on the directory board in the lobby, but it was not to be found.
How curious.
I stood for a moment with my heart in my boots, wondering whether the whole thing was an elaborate hoax, when someone suddenly addressed me. I looked up, and there before me was a man very like the chap that I had seen the night before. He was the same size with the same voice, but he was clean-shaven and his hair was of a lighter color. Clearly, the men were brothers. If it hadn't been for the hair, one of them might have said they were twins.
Are you Mr. Hall Pycroft?
Yes, sir, I am.
I was expecting you, but you are a trifle before your time. I had a note from my brother this morning in which he sings your praises.
I was just looking for the offices when you came.
We have not put our name up yet, for we only secured this temporary premises last week. Come up with me, and we'll talk the whole thing over.
I followed him to the top of a lofty staircase, and there, right under the roof, were two empty, dusty little rooms, uncurtained and uncarpeted. I had imagined a great office with shining tables and rows of clerks, such as I was used to. And I dare say I rather stared at two rickety chairs and one little table with which a ledger made up the whole of the furniture.
Come, Mr. Pycroft, don't be disheartened by humble appearances. Rome was not built in a day, and we have lots of money behind us, though we don't make much of a show with it. Pray sit down. From what my brother has written me of you, I know that you are the man we want. You may consider yourself definitely engaged.
What are my duties to be, Mr. Pinner?
You will eventually manage the great depot in Paris, which will pour a flood of English crockery into shops of 134 agents in France. The purchase will be completed in a week. Meanwhile, you will remain here in Birmingham and make yourself useful.
How?
Here's the directory of Paris, with the trays listed after the names of the people. I want you to take it home with you and mark off all the Hardwell sellers with their addresses. It would be of the greatest use to me to have them.
But surely, sir, there are classified lists available.
Not reliable ones. Their system is different from ours. Stick at it and let me have the list by Monday at 12. If you continue to show good zeal and intelligence, you will find us a good company. Good day, Mr. Pycroft.
Well, gentlemen, what was I to think? The dingy offices, the lack of furniture, the absence of the company name upon the directory board? All of these things gave rise to my suspicions, and yet Mr. Pinner had offered a good explanation for everything. Even the task he had set me to seemed reasonable, and so I gave it a try. All Sunday I was kept hard at work. And yet by Monday, I had only gotten as far as the letter H. I went round to Mr. Pinner, found him in the same dismantled room, and was told to keep at it until Wednesday. On Wednesday, it was still unfinished, so I hammered away until Friday, that is, yesterday. Then I brought it around to Mr. Harry Pinner.
Thank you very much, Mr. Pycroft. I fear that I underrated the difficulty of the task. This list will be of very material assistance to me.
It took some time.
And now I want you to make a list of the furniture shops, for they all sell crockery.
Very good, sir, if that's what you want.
And you can come up tomorrow evening at 7 and let me know how you are getting on. But don't overwork yourself, my boy. Have a couple of hours at the music hall in the evening, would you? You a world of good. Yes, yes, Mr. Pycroft, take your time. There's no hurry. By all means, take your time.
And that, Dr. Watson, is the whole story.
And do you think there is some mystery in the business? It all sounds perfectly legitimate and straightforward to me.
But that is because Mr. Pycroft neglected to tell you one interesting thing which he observed, a thing of a most peculiar nature.
By George, I did leave that out.
What is it, man?
As Mr. Harry Pinner discharged me last evening, he left, as I told you. And I saw that his second tooth upon the left-hand side had been very badly filled with gold.
And is that all? That doesn't sound like much to me.
You are quite right, Dr. Watson. There is much more to it. When I was speaking to the other chap in London, Mr. Arthur Pinner, I happened to notice the same tooth was filled in the identical fashion. Of course, you would expect that two brothers would resemble each other, but not that they would have the same tooth filled in the exact same way. And then it suddenly occurred to me that the only differences in their appearances were such things that might be quickly altered with a razor and with dye. The things that can't be quickly changed, the voice, the figure, the teeth, the eyes, those were all the same.
An excellent observation, you will agree, Watson.
But if both men were the same, what is the meaning of it? Why had he sent you from London to Birmingham? Why had he gone there early to meet you? And why had he written a letter from himself to himself?
Those are the very questions I asked myself, Dr. Watson. And because I could not answer them, I went to the one man in all of England who could help me find the answers. That is precisely why I've called upon your good friend, Sherlock Holmes.
I confess that I found Mr. Pycroft's story interesting, but it was not until he mentioned the detail of the gold tooth that I perceived the mystery in the affair. Now, however, I could understand why Holmes had shown such enthusiasm for the case. The train had pulled into Birmingham Station just as Pycroft finished his narrative, and the three of us climbed down onto the platform. Both the young stockbroker's clerk and I turned upon Holmes with eager anticipation, anxious to know how he intended to proceed with the business.
Rather fine, Watson, is it not? There are points in it which please me. I think you will agree with me that an interview with Mr. Arthur Harry Pinner, for we must call him by both names until we can discover who he really is, in the temporary offices of the Franco-Medlin Hardware Company Limited. Rather fine, Watson, is it not? There are points in it which please me. I think you will agree with me that an interview with Mr. Arthur Harry Pinner, for we must call him by both names until we discover who he really is, in the temporary offices of the Franco-Medlin Hardware Company Limited, would be a rather interesting experience for both of us.
But how can we manage it without his suspecting who we are?
Oh, easily enough. You can pretend to be two friends of mine who are in need of jobs. What could be more natural than that I should bring both you around to the managing director of my company?
Quite so, quite so. I should like to have a look at the gentleman and see if I can make anything of his little game. I can't help but wonder, Mr. Pycroft, what it is about you that should have attracted him.
Shall we go right over to the offices now?
There's no use in that. He comes there only to see me, apparently, for the place is deserted up till the very hour he names.
That is certainly suggestive of mischief.
I say, we're in luck. There he is, ahead of us, the very man.
Which one? Where?
That one there, with his head lower. He must have come down on the same train as we did.
He's probably on his way to keep his appointment with you now, Mr. Pycroft. At least we will not be disappointed. I find myself quite anxious to have a good long look at Mr. Arthur Harry Pinner.
The man Pycroft had pointed to was a smallish, well-dressed fellow who seemed quite intent upon his own thoughts, for he never once looked up but went bustling along the streets with firm determination. Following him at a short distance, Holmes, Pycroft, and I never lost sight of him, and soon we found ourselves walking down the street of the company's offices. At the corner, there was a young urchin selling newspapers.
All London papers here. Get your evening papers here.
Here, boy, a standard, and be quick about it.
Pinner threw the boy a coin, and clutching his newspaper tightly, he bustled off into the company's building, a worried look on his face. Following Pycroft's lead, we entered the same doorway, and after climbing five flights of stairs, found ourselves outside a half-opened door, at which our client tapped. We entered a bare, unfinished room, such had been described to us. At the single table sat the man whom we had seen in the street, with his evening paper spread in front of him. And as he looked up, I saw an expression of grief, torment, and horror. His brow glistened with perspiration. His cheeks were dead white. His eyes glazed. He looked at his clerk as though he did not recognize him, so preoccupied was he with his own terrible thoughts.
You look ill, Mr. Pinner.
Yes, I am not very well. Who are these gentlemen?
They are friends of mine, who are in need of work, and I thought you might be able to make use of their experience in your enterprise.
Yes, yes, possibly, quite possibly. But I cannot talk about it now. Please leave me alone for a little bit. I must be alone.
You forget, Mr. Pinner, that I am here by appointment.
Appointment? Yes, of course. I beg your pardon. You may wait here. You may all wait here. I must just slip away. If you will excuse me, I must go into the next room. Only for a moment. Excuse me, just for a moment. I must be alone, just for a moment.
Is he trying to give us the slip?
It's impossible. There's no door in that second room except the one he entered by. It's an inside room, not so much as a window in it.
Is it furnished?
It wasn't yesterday.
Then what on earth can he be doing in there? Probably went in merely to recover his composure. He did seem awfully upset. I say, do you suppose he suspects we are detectives? Is that what's upset him?
No, he was already upset when we came in.
What's that?
It's Pinner. See what he's up to.
Good grief!
He's hanged himself. How is he, Watson?
Dead, by Jove. He's made a good job of it. Dead as a doornail.
I suppose we ought to call the police in, and yet I confess that I'd like to give them a complete case when they come.
It's a blessed mystery to me. Whatever did he want to bring me all the way up here for when he...
Pooh, all that is clear enough. It is just this last sudden move that has me confused.
You understand the rest, then? I must confess that I am out of my depth.
Surely if you consider the events at first, they can only point to one conclusion. The whole thing hinges upon two points. The first is that he made Pycroft write a declaration by which he entered the services of this preposterous company. Do you not see how very suggestive it is?
No, I am afraid I don't.
Why did they want him to do it? It's not a usual business practice, you know. The only reason is that they were anxious to obtain a specimen of our young friend's handwriting.
But why should they need my handwriting?
There can only be one adequate reason. Someone wished to learn to imitate it. And for the explanation of why, we must consider the second point, that you were specifically requested not to resign your position at Mawson's, but to leave the manager there under expectation that Mr. Paul Pycroft, whom he had never seen, was about to enter the office upon the next Monday morning.
Of course! What a blind fool I've been!
Suppose that someone turned up in your place, writing in a hand identical to that in which your letter of application was written. How easy it would be for him to pass himself off as you. Of course, it is of the utmost importance to persuade you to accept the fake job offer, for it was essential that an impostor go to Mawson's in your place. That is why you were given the magnificent sum of £100 in advance. They wanted to make sure of you. And, of course, that very cleverly arranged for you to leave London so that there would be no chance of your showing up at Mawson's on any pretext.
But why should this man pretend to have been his brother?
That is pretty clear also. There are evidently only two of them in on the scheme, whatever scheme it is. The other is impersonating you at the office. This one acted as your engager and then found that it was wiser to pretend to be your Birmingham employer as well, rather than admit a third person into the plot. He changed his appearance and passed himself off as his own brother. But for the happy accident of the gold tooth, he would have succeeded.
But what scheme were they working? Why should one of them want to gain entrance to Mawson's under false pretense?
And why should the other hang himself the minute we walk into the room?
That is what I do not yet understand. The paper. Of course. I should have thought of it before. The secret must lie there.
Here's the newspaper Pinner was reading. What do you make of it?
It's an early edition of the Evening Standard. Let me see. Aha, here it is. Look at this, Watson, and tell us what you think.
Ah! Listen to the headline of this story. Murder at Mawson and Williams. Gigantic robbery attempted. Capture of the criminal.
I begin to understand.
By pretending to be you, the criminal managed to gain access to the safe. I gather from the newspaper that he was discovered by a guard whom he killed, but fortunately the police caught him in time. And this fellow, when he learned the jig was up, decided to kill himself.
Yes, Holmes, listen to this. The criminal is lodged in Holloway Jail. His brother, however, who usually works with him, has not appeared in this job as far as we can presently ascertain, although the police are making energetic enquiries as to his whereabouts.
Well, we may save the police some little trouble in that direction.
It's ironic, isn't it? To think that this fellow really had a brother in London after all.
I must congratulate you, Holmes, on your splendid deductions.
You could have done the same, Watson.
I disagree. You have pieced the thing together with uncanny skill. I don't know how you do it. It's amazing.
On the contrary, it is elementary, my dear Watson. Elementary.
We hope you enjoyed this Sherlock Holmes Radio Christmas show brought to you by the Petrie California Wines, performed by the What the Hay Players. The What the Hay Players are
Dan Chinnick,
Jordan Parsons,
Jerry Jackson,
Trish Neary,
Will Milhans,
Rob Krantz,
and me, Michael Puente. From all of us, Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
The bells begin to ring, the holly's in the window, and the birds begin to sing. Now don't take time to worry.